Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, it is a bi-week episode. We will get the pulse of the fan base, ask for listener questions, and received well into triple digits. So we will not be able to touch on everybody's inquiry. We've done our best to group these together, pair as many like questions as possible. So interested to hear your thoughts a little bit more from the weight game. Certainly enjoyed the instant reaction podcast that you did. We'll spend some time looking at that game in particular, but most of it will be a byproduct of questions asked of us. So with that, we will begin the conversation, Bud. And any time that we get together and are fortunate enough to do this, we probably need to thank our sponsors, Louisiana Hot Sauce, a fantastic partner and a fantastic product. I continue to put it on damn near everything that that comes out of my kitchen. It is incredibly easy. It is incredibly forgiving. It's not something that you'll ever ruin a meal with, and it's a great, cheap way to improve the taste of just about anything. So always want to thank them and encourage you to interact with them on social media, as many of you have, and would always appreciate if you would pick a bottle of it up next time you go out to the grocery store.
And when you go to the grocery store to pick that up, you realize how cheap it is. Ingram, I don't know what the cost up is there up in Atlanta, but down here in Florida, man, Louisiana Hot Sauce is super cheap. I think my bottle was like 89 cents or something the other day at Publix.
It's insanely cheap.
That's a really good value.
Oh, what I said at the beginning of the year, there's no more economical way to improve a meal. I mean, you're literally talking about pennies on the dollar. So it's you may love it, you may like it, you may not. You will not be out of a whole lot of money to try it the first time. I'm honestly insincere when I talk about how much I enjoy using it and how good of a product it is, but it's not going to sink you one way or another.
Also, I like how it's calorie free, right? When I'm on the road covering college football, sometimes you can't eat all that well. But Louisiana Hot Sauce is not going to pack the pounds on you, right? It's not like mayo or teriyaki sauce or something with calories in it. You look at that bottle, just three ingredients: peppers, vinegar, salt. That's it. It's simple, it's sound, but it works.
If only everything in life was effective as Louisiana Hot Sauce, Bud. Maybe
you don't got to overcomplicate it.
Maybe if Florida State's first half offense bared some resemblance to simplicity and just beautiful success found in simple products.
Ingram, I think I got all my negativity out on Sunday, so I'm going to be real positive during this episode. Heck, I'm not even sure, after listening to Jimbo Fisher's comments, if there's actually an issue with the offense in the first half. Maybe there isn't. Maybe I'm just off base on this.
Yeah, that's something we'll be able to touch on more. And it's pretty much undeniable at this point that there's some things. You know, you can always go and look at particular drives. You can look at particular games. You can always find things to comment on. And there's some real legitimacy to that, but we're halfway through the season, and you've got to, you know, this is not a new issue, and it's been a little bit of an overarching issue from the beginning of the year as far as how the team as a whole played. The defense has recently played a little bit of a higher level, but you know, the situation with the offense is at a point where I think it really needs to be talked about. I also don't think people appreciate how much that kind of permeates your team. It impacts what the play caller on the opposing team feels comfortable doing. You know, look, if you're up 17-3, then you're a lot more likely to be a little bit more aggressive and pull out some things of the playbook that you might not otherwise. So I don't want to go down a rabbit hole or find myself in a rabbit hole with this, but it's an issue, and it's something that, yes, the defense has had its flaws. The defense has been better recently, but I even to an extent don't think people appreciated how much of the offensive woes may have contributed to the defensive shortcomings, and certainly they are by no means not responsible for some really historically pathetic efforts. But what you're getting out of the offense this year, yes, we can look at the halftime numbers, what you get, but still not to score a touchdown, if I'm correct in that, in the first quarter. And we're not talking about the Charleston Southern game here. But that's a trend that is going to have to end. Otherwise, you will find yourself out of the game and out of the game and with a quickness against Clemson come not this Saturday, but next Saturday, obviously.
Yeah, this thing that's not an issue is something that maybe should not be worked on during the bye week, if you catch my drift. We're going to just double negative this thing up. Ingram, we actually have a little more concrete numbers on it now that my colleague at SB Nation, Bill Connolly, put out his advanced stats from the game. Florida State, just a 31% success rate in the first quarter, just 45% in the second quarter. They did indeed turn it on in the second half, 65% in Q3, 53% in Q4, but 31% coming out of the locker room in the first half is horrible. And really, they didn't come out of the locker room that well in the second half either. They started with two turnovers, I believe, but they ended up really turning things on after that.
But give a little bit more of a background, if you will, just to the listeners as far as what you mean when you say 31%.
Sure. So success rate, I believe, is gaining half of the necessary yardage for first down on first down. So if it's first and 10, then that would be gaining at least 5 yards. Mm-hmm. Conley's numbers have shown that in order to have a successful drive, most of the time you need to be gaining 5 or more yards on first down. On second down, I believe it's 70% of the necessary yards. So let's say that you still had second and 10. Then a successful play would be picking, you know, getting back to third and 3, something right like that. On third down or fourth down, it's obviously gaining 100% of the needed yards. So basically staying ahead of the chains, having successful plays. For instance, Ole Miss in the Q3 of that game had 0% success rate. They did not have a single play that was successful. Wake Forest in this game, Q1, 14%, Q2, 23%, Q3, 21%, Q4, 38%. Granted, I think a decent number at 38% for Wake Forest was on their final drive, but you know, only 49% for the game from Florida State, which is really not that great. But the 31% in the first quarter and the 45 in Q2, that's just not good.
It's a Wake Forest team that we talked about in the preview. It's a good defensive team. It's you know, what they had kind of built that 5-1 record around, but it's not a stellar unit by any means, and it certainly pales in comparison with what you'll see in 2 weeks. And we've got a lot of time to talk about the Clemson game, and this is not the Clemson podcast preview by any means, but that is a team that if you come out and don't have an offensive effort, Clemson gets, you know, 14-0, certainly 17-0 up on you, as you've been wont to let a lot of lesser talent teams do. Then, you don't ever want to say Florida State's not going to come back in a situation, but I have a hard time seeing Florida State have much of a chance against Clemson in general. But if you go out and lay a goose egg in the first quarter, certainly if we're looking at 7 minutes in the, 7 minutes to halftime and the offense hasn't put up any points, then unless you have some kind of stellar defensive performance, which I have a hard time projecting, you can't come out like this as an offense, I guess, is my overarching theme here, and it's tough to find a reason to think that they're going to change from what you've seen halfway through the year so far.
I totally agree with you, mate. Now, Igor, I will be a little bit positive here in some ways. I do think this is a beat-up football team. The bye week, I don't think any coach will ever say is not coming at the right time, but certainly this bye week is well needed. DeAndre Francois was really not very good in this game. In terms of his throws, his reads were probably okay. For the most part, he was throwing to the correct man. Obviously, he had the interception, which was just a bad decision. Even a good throw there gets picked off. Whitfield is well covered on the pick. But you know, in the first half, if you take out the – we need a better phrase for this, but the Hail Mary that didn't count for anything, He was 7 of 19 for 47 yards. And he started the second half over 2 with a pick. So if you do that, I mean, his first 21 throws in this game, he was 7 of 21 for 47 yards with an INT. That's, I mean, ugh. I don't even know what the quarterback rating is on that. It can't be good. I mean, 33% for 2.35 yards per attempt. Gross. With an interception, he had some open guys in the first half. I will give Jimbo Fisher, absolutely give him credit for this. Now, should they be running some different stuff on offense? Probably. However, some of these balls are just nowhere near catchable, and you have to be able to make these throws. And I'm not talking about the ones he was under pressure on, and there were definitely a number of plays under which he was under pressure. Most of them not his fault. Some of them certainly his fault. Some of them absolutely the offensive line's fault, by the way. Some of them also Dalvin Cook and tight end's faults for kind of lackluster pass blocking efforts. 2 of the 3 sacks were certainly on backs and tight ends. But is there a reason to think this offense gets better in first halves? Yeah, I think potentially if they get healthier, if they get more comfortable in the system. I mean, do I think it's going to be a whole lot better in first halves? Probably not, but man, it's hard to diagnose exactly why they play poorly in the first half. We can do the Jimbo Fisher thing and say, well, there was an error here, and there was an error there, and there was an error here, and there was an error there. But this team is consistently markedly better in the second half of games on offense. Why does that happen? I think it's a systemic or a cultural issue, and it's very difficult to diagnose. And I think if Jimbo Fisher knew the problem, then he would fix it. But I don't know if he knows. Because, I mean, we're talking about, what 6 games into the season here? But maybe...
And it's never been this pronounced, but it's not a completely, entirely new phenomenon either.
Correct. So maybe there is some randomness element to that. Like, I can't totally dismiss this as something that has no random element in there. Maybe there is something that's random in it. And if you will buy that, then certainly there's probably something to that. I do think Florida State did a better job in the second half. If you want to really dig into this data, Florida State did a better job staying out of third and long. And by third and long, I mean third and 5+. You don't really think of 5+ as third and long. But if you get the 3rd and 5+, it means you've really not done a very good job on 1st and 2nd down, some combination thereof. Florida State converted, you want to guess how many? 1 of 9 third downs that were 3rd and 5 or longer. That's pretty poor.
That'll hurt your feelings. Yeah,
I mean, that's tough. That's terrible. If you look at look at DeAndre Francois' numbers in this game, on passing downs, which is, you know, that. 7 of 16 for 86 yards. 44% yards per attempt. What's 86 into 16? Or 16 into 86? Not very good. However, think about this too. He also threw his only pick on a third or on a passing down. And all 3 sacks came on passing downs. When you factor in the sacks, the yards per attempt from DeAndre Francois when the defense knew he was going to pass, a paltry 2.84 yards per attempt. And I know this is a podcast and that sometimes these numbers don't translate all that well. And for that, I certainly apologize to the listener, but I think that this can mean something. Let's compare that to standard downs. And by standard downs, I mean the downs that we're running the football is a legitimate threat, right? 15 of 21 for 233 yards. Now, that includes the fail Mary, because it was a failure because it didn't get into the end zone. That's, you know, let's take that out. Without that, you know what he was? 14 of 20 for 175 yards. That's a completion percentage of, like, what, 68? No interceptions, no sacks. Yards per attempt, 11.1. So, if you want to compare this on standard downs where the run game was an actual threat, 11.1, passing downs where it was not 2.84. Why? A couple reasons, I think. Number one, Francois is not very quick to read defenses. Number two, his mechanics are not necessarily good anyway, but when he was hurt, I think they suffered more. Mm-hmm. Number three, he is not good in the pocket. He has really bad pocket awareness and movement so far. Now, maybe that can improve some, but he does not slide in the pocket well. He basically drops very deep, and he just stands there as opposed to shuffle around in the pocket. You really don't see him do that very well. Jameis did it well. Ponder at times did it well. EJ, not so much. But Francois does not have – you know what I mean? Like, he does not – for being as quick as he is, he does not move within the pocket. The pocket mobility is poor. And I think number four here, the pass protection in this game on those passing downs was not good. The offensive line got beat a number of times. Really just that group is underperforming its talent level and its experience level, in my opinion. But not only that, you had Ryan Izzo get whipped. You had other tight ends missing blocks. You had Dalvin Cook, inexcuable kind of Olay block there on the defensive end. Now, he chased the guy down after Francois fumbled, but so some pressure. And then I think reason number five was that Florida State receivers really don't scare anybody, which is a huge indictment of the program. I mean, this is Florida State, and I know Travis Rudolph had a huge day, but, does he really scare you? He's not a true number one. I mean, he had 238 yards, 58 were that long Phil Mary. Still, a pretty good day, but I don't think he's honestly scary.
Rudolph scares me if I'm like a 5-6 team with a really below average defense. And let's not be too crazy pessimistic. Rudolph is a solid player and a great asset for the program. Not bagging on the kid, but he tends to have his real breakout games against significantly inferior competition. Had a nice performance in the bowl game last year against Houston, but he knows when to really make the most out of some stats.
Absolutely.
Here's the other thing, but I think if we're going to try to be fair and just have an honest talk about what we've seen so far, I think we knew coming into the year that Florida State was facing a tough schedule. Would have been impossible and really hard to predict that this would be that schedule. I think this is a much better slate of teams than we even could have projected coming into the year. I mean, Clemson is we'll find out. Louisville is way above what we probably thought coming into the year. Hard to believe that South Florida has the record that they do. Carolina, Miami, you can take that for what you will, but it's a really tough slate, and they've certainly faced some good teams, particularly some good offenses.
So I agree with you there, but really, are any of those teams other than Louisville that much better than you thought they'd be? I mean, I think everybody thought USF would be a ranked team. I mean, that they were pretty clearly the number two team in the AAC and were destined to meet Houston there in the championship game. I think Louisville's the difference there. But even with the Louisville loss, you know, this team is being outscored in ACC play so far through four games.
That does not surprise me.
I mean, they're probably going to be outscored for the season, don't you think, in ACC play?
Unless you're able to put a number on somebody, and it doesn't look like, NC State is not going to be an easy game. Syracuse, what they did this weekend to Virginia Tech, certainly has to catch your attention. No, I'm not sure that I see a place on the schedule where you get to make up the number that you put up against Louisville.
I mean, right now you're down 30. You're 33 points in the red in ACC play. Assuming you lose to Clemson by double digits. You know, let's say Clemson wins by 10. Okay, you're down 43. You're going to make that up over the final four games at NC State, Boston College, and Syracuse? Maybe, but man, to be anywhere close to even in terms of net points, that's points scored minus points allowed if you're scoring at home, that's embarrassing. And to come off a quote-unquote learning year or rebuilding year, that's unacceptable, man. But I don't want to harp on the negativity. You want to get into what the readers are thinking?
All right, bud. Conversation that might have gotten a little bit darker than we intended, but an honest reflection as far as what we've seen through half the year, and particularly what we saw from the Wake Forest game. Let's get to questions. Hopefully have a little bit of fun with this. Try to be honest as possible as far as what we see. But also there's some good out there, and we will touch on that as well. And with that in mind, probably a very appropriate first question. Jeff asks, what is the most positive thing that you've taken away from the first half? Young talent stepping up, question, hopefully something else.
Now, does he mean the first half of this game or the first half of the season?
I believe this is a first half of the season question. First of all, look, I don't know that the kid's ever going to be an All-American, but I was pretty close to just dismissing your right tackle in general. Brock Rubel's played at a much higher level than I would have anticipated. I don't have a whole lot of things that I can say for the offensive side of the ball that's been kind of surprisingly positive. But that is one of them. Yeah, that and look, you've got a, you know what you have at quarterback as far as buy-in and how tough of a kid you have. There's certainly some flaws that we can point out in his game, and one of them's that he probably has to display that toughness too frequently with a penchant to hold the ball. But DeAndre Francois' level of play, I would say, is probably what I expected. Some of the intangibles that surround Francois are way higher than I could have anticipated coming into camp. So, Bud, you have any for the offense, or most of the positive things that come from what you've seen fall on the defense side of the ball?
Well, I think overall, I have more positives on the offense than the defense, I guess. I think Dalvin Cook's receiving of the football is really encouraging. I know he had a bad drop in his last game and whatnot, but look at his receiving this year compared to last year. Last year, 244, previous year, 203, 24 catches last year, 22 and 14. He's already at 21 catches and 356 yards this year. He's already had three games with four more catches: Louisville, North Carolina, and Mississippi State. And they've not all been easy catches. Florida State's throwing him the football more and in various ways. And even in the, they had a 59 yarder against Miami. Obviously, they snuck him out of the backfield. I'm encouraged by Dalvin Cook's catching the football, and also by his determination to play through pain after his effort in the first couple games. I echo your thought that I'm very encouraged by DeAndre Francois' toughness. I'll stand by my thought that I don't think he's a top 20 quarterback in college football right now. Now, he's a redshirt freshman, so I'm not even sure that's a fair designation, but some people had asked about that the other day after some debate on Twitter. I would have to say that I'm encouraged by freshman Landon Dickerson. I think he's played well for a true freshman. I like that tight end Maven Saunders has stepped up, right? He's blocking better, and he's caught some nice passes. And I'm
definitely encouraged. Have to include what you've gotten out of Saunders. Yeah, that's been a great thing to see, the emergence of Maven Saunders.
I'm encouraged that you have a Saunders-Izzo combo for the next 2 years, assuming they don't turn pro early, which is certainly a possibility. I think Rod Johnson has played much better this year. Like I think he's taken a step forward from where he was last year.
Mm-hmm.
The concerns that people had about him after the Ole Miss game, where he got his foot stepped on a couple times, it seemed to have gone down quite a bit. Defensively, I think DeMarcus Walker's taken another step. I don't think he's a first-round draft pick, or at least not a high one. But he's probably improved his stock some coming back to school. I think Derek Nnadi's playing really well right now. I mean, overall, has not had a good year, but maybe he was more hurt than we realized. I'm encouraged by some things Tavarius McFadden is doing. But, this is a team with, I think, top five-ish talent that's playing like a top 20 level. So it's hard to find that many things we'd possibly about.
Ermon Lane certainly been a nice emergence.
There we go.
Looked like that was a career we were probably about to write off. That's something that I think we'll probably be asked about a couple times in the questions to follow. But that's been nice. I certainly echo your sentiments about McFadden. Shown an act to make a play when the chance presents itself. Had some nice moments. Had some others that'll make you scratch your head. But that's what comes when you're true sophomore starting. Some growing pains are to be expected. That would be about the most the positives that I would find when looking over the defense side of the ball so far.
Hey, I will say that DeAndre Francois might already be better than Ryan Fitzpatrick, who is a 3 of 8 for 16 yards on third down tonight. Not the best. Some of these passes are just, ugh. I have the Monday night game going on in the background here, and this is pretty poor. What else do we got?
Next question, Bud. With Bobo out, will we finally see AT-18 and have the deep ball threat? Obviously, a Auden Tate question here.
Perhaps, yeah. But in Jimbo Fisher's offense, remember, it's not really about ability. It's about having a PhD in route running and understanding all the different checks and the ways you need to break off your routes against certain coverage. So in other offenses, I do think that if you had Tate's size and ability to catch the ball, that he would be force-fed the ball a lot more and just be told, hey, use your size and do that. But not in this offense. So we'll see. Maybe they'll end up playing more double tights or more I formation and not use Tate more. I don't think Bubba Wilson's coming back anytime soon, by the way. That did not look good. That's a non-contact foot injury where he comes up completely lame. He already has his shoe off. I'm not expecting him back this year, and at least not anytime soon. But I do think you'll see Auden Tate play a little more. If Jimbo Fisher was smart, he would realize, and I'm not saying he's not smart, but in this regard, or in this specific case, I think that you do need to start playing these young guys more just to if they find some success, great, they get some confidence. If they don't, then it's a good reminder of how hard they need to work next offseason. Your season goals are already shot for this year. We've already said, look, this season can either be disaster or it can be disappointment, but it you've already lost 2 games and you haven't even played Clemson yet. And if you beat Clemson, you're still not playing for the ACC title game because you slipped up and mismanaged a game and lost to North Carolina. I did not intend to spin that in the North Carolina loss response. But, yeah, there's definitely possible that Tate will step up. Now, he's not really a burner deep threat, right? But he is a guy who can catch a contested football and use his size and his length. I think he's also going to help, and this is something I want to point out. When you have all these midgets running around there at receiver, it impacts your ability to block, right? Jimbo Fisher on his TV show and in the press conference laments the lack of blocking on some of these screens. Well, man, if you got a guy that's 5'8 trying to block somebody with no strength in his body, A, his reach is really poor, so he's got to get right up on him. There's a chance he isn't able to touch him or that block's able to be shed really easy. A taller guy who actually has the ability to impact somebody. Man, if Auden Tate pushes somebody, that's got a much bigger impact than if Travis Rudolph or Kermit Whitfield or Bobo push somebody. Not only because of their physical ability, but also because of their length. I do think that having Auden Tate in there more could help the run game. And I think Devontae Phillips has a very limited ceiling, but he could also help the run game some and the screen game if he's in there a little bit more.
Started to almost mention Tate in the previous question. Statistically, he's had a nice year when you look at what 8 catches, 4 of them have been touchdowns. If you're going to tell me through 7 games, if Tate had 4 touchdowns, I'd say, he's become a pretty large part of your offense. Be nice to see him be worked into the more all-encompassing offense. And I agree with you. It's 11 o'clock on Monday night when we are recording, but I will expect that you probably have a story out sometime tomorrow that confirms that you're probably not going to get Bobo back. So it'll be interesting to see what the contingency plan is and how much it involves Auden Tate. And I too agree with you. It wouldn't shock me if you didn't see a hell of a lot more double tight moving forward. So, Bud, interesting question here from Daniel. He asked, wouldn't Dalvin's pass pro issues be resolved or at least help if Jimbo gave the guy a rest for number nine every once in a while?
Well, so, okay, let's get at the crux of this question from Daniel. It's basically implying that Dalvin is too tired to pass protect or is losing focus because he's in the game too much. Is that what he's getting at here?
Perhaps an argument, and I could see the argument he would make, is that he'd be a little bit better if the weight of the carry load was dispersed a little bit more. Maybe not so much that he's fatigued, but if he had a little bit more rotation, he'd be better at pass blocking.
Okay, so maybe I can buy that. I think that there was a lack of focus in this game from some players due to the fact that it was Wake Forest. Maybe. Sure. But I don't think that's the reason why he missed the pass block. You just got to make that block.
I think there's two really different things here. One is, I'm not sure. Look, Dalvin's your star, and particularly the past three games, he's run as well as anybody in the country. He's back to the level that that he's kind of spoiled us with. But working Jacquez Patrick into the mix more, I think, is something that you've got to do. You don't want to force it, but really, I think it would be better for both of them. It'd be better for Florida State as a whole. Would it have some nice byproducts as far as letting Dalvin potentially be better in pass blocking? Maybe. Tough to say whether or not that's true, but it certainly wouldn't hurt him, you would think. But it is, in some of the storylines that we talked about overall, as you kind of round the corner for the back part of this season, it will be interesting, and I'll have my eye as much as anything as far as how much number nine, what his carries look like, and how much he's worked into the offense.
I agree with you. I think that there are two things afoot.
Bud Chandler asks, more worried about a potential L coming to at Syracuse this point or hosting Florida at Doak?
Florida at Doak. Just because I think Florida can cause a bunch of problems for Francois. And that game has potential to be a kind of low possession, high turnover game. And I get the worry about Syracuse because they are a tempo team and because they do run that offense. And it's also a look-ahead game. But I don't think Syracuse plays enough defense to beat FSU. And I know they just beat Virginia Tech, certainly. But I don't think Jimbo Fisher will let Florida State lose that game. Like, you want to see a game where Dalvin Cook gets 45 carries or something like that, because if you lose that game, hoo boy. I'd be more worried about losing to Florida. James asks, FSU will beat Clemson if blank.
Yeah, James, I wish I had an absolute recipe or an absolute answer for that. If they come out and are able to buck the trend of not being very successful on offense, obviously. I also say that I think you're going to have some kind of significant large play in the first 10 minutes or so to really fortify the belief. Not that Florida State, I think, ever steps on a field right now with the amount of talent and doesn't think that they are capable of beating that opponent, but I think you'd need something significant to really get the most out of the crowd that's possible. And, if it's a pick six, if it's a forced fumble, I think you need some kind of large momentum play from the beginning and something to feed off that that night atmosphere that you'll get in Tallahassee next Saturday.
I'll agree with you. Ingram, I'll say this. They will beat Clemson if they are plus four in turnovers. I think they could beat Clemson if they're plus three. My concerns about how what they're doing currently on defense not really translating to Clemson is that concern is still very much there.
Yeah. It would also help if maybe two of three of the future NFL players that reside on Clemson's defensive line somehow get sick or food poisoning or something like that. You're going to have something. Look, Lawrence has been everything that that the recruiting ranking suggests he might be. I really think that the sophomore Watkins is or Christian Wilkins. I get the two confused, very similar last names. I think that kid's really as good of any defensive lineman in the country. That's a hell of a unit, and I have deep concern for what Florida State will be able to do up front against them. So yeah, something that's kind of said tongue in cheek, but wouldn't hurt if you didn't have some kind of personnel issue along Clemson's front.
Yeah, I don't think Florida State can block Clemson, and really nobody's blocked Clemson all year. So that's not anything new. All right, okay. If FSU plays a scrimmage against itself for a half right before the game starts, could we score two touchdowns in the legitimate first half, please? That's from Shrimpton. Shrimpton, that's an interesting name. Again, a question that gets at the first half issues that we discussed. Look, certainly something needs to be changed with how Florida State comes out in the first half, because you can say it's a mistake here, it's a mistake there, but it's a bunch of mistakes, and that's on coaching, but that's also on preparation and mentality. And I don't know if it's, you know, too long locker room speeches, made for TV speeches, or whatever, but something's not right when they come out. They can't just talk about starting fast. They need to change up what they're doing, I think, because you can say believe in the process, but the process is broken, at least as far as first half offense. So they do need to change something up there.
Next question comes from AP. AP asks, concern with the lack of performance the last two games, the offensive lack of performance the last two games, are just tough opposition in Miami and a little bit of a sloppy game against Wake?
No, I think there's a legitimate reason for concern. This is still a good offense. It's just not an offense that you would think needs to be on a team that is contending for a playoff spot, which Florida State no longer is. So if you're cool with dropping your expectations, then his offense is just fine, I guess. But yeah, I think there are some concerning trends, most notably Francois taking a bunch of hits. He does hold on to the ball a while, and that's, I think, in part because he's not very quick to process what he's seeing out there. Yeah, I think there's definitely room for concern.
Yeah, Adam asks if Jimbo refuses to emphasize the RPO, the run-past option, could he turn to Henry next year, assuming he becomes the better pocket passer of the two?
Well, the question says could, so I guess there's some chance that he could. I don't think that he will. I think Malik Henry is pretty significantly behind, and I don't know if he's going to be here next year, so I guess we'll have to see. But yeah, I think it's possible. The part about refuses to emphasize RPO probably gets into this philosophical debate. You know, do you think DeAndre Francois can become a good pocket passer, or do you think it's important to take advantage of the rules in college football as they're currently constructed, such that Alabama and Louisville have kind of scrapped their pro style offenses to run the spread option? Or maybe you think you can develop him into this, Jameis 2.0. I think the listeners certainly know where I stand on that. But Henry, I think he's pretty significantly behind from what I understand. All right, Colin asks, what is this terrible, awful, horrendous, and many more adjectives in offensive line going to do against Clemson to protect Francois? Well, I would say they'd probably have to be more assignment sound, first of all, because they're going to get beat physically a decent number of times against Clemson, like everybody does. But what you can't have is the missed assignments, just turn guys free and wide open at the quarterback. You also are going to need help from your tight ends and backs, who have not done a very good job helping out this year in pass protection. And then you're going to need your quarterback to understand when he's the hot guy, because Clemson is a team that will blitz a lot at times. And if you don't recognize as the QB that the opposing team is bringing more blitzers than your team can block just numerically, If they bring six rushers and you only have five blockers or seven versus six, then you are responsible for that unblocked defender. And you have got to hot the ball out of there. And so far, Francois does not do that very well. He's a redshirt freshman. I don't know how well we should expect him to do that. But it's certainly not a strength of his at this point. So, yeah, you're going to need some help, and you're going to need to get really assignment sound in 2 weeks, which probably won't happen, which I think is why both of us are picking Clemson to win that game 2 weeks from now.
Be interesting to see how much help they try to give situationally, like we talked about previously with the impact of Bobo. Wouldn't shock me to see a little bit more double tight look, which limits you in your options downfield, but also can help you in some of the what you do up front and pass protection. You may see more of Freddie Stevenson. It'd be curious to see what they do. I do think you have to scheme it a little bit differently. Yes, the bye week will help Francois, but look, it's not, you don't have to be overly concerned, or you're not necessarily like having a moment of hyperbole for effect if you say that if the offensive line and Francois, like you referenced, both contribute in setting up a situation where he has as much exposure to Clemson's defensive line as he has other units, then you have to have real concern for whether or not he finishes that game. And if, look, an injury can occur anytime in football, but you let Clemson's defensive line tee off on your quarterback multiple times, there's just eventually you're going to end up sustaining a pretty serious injury. So I do look for them probably to do a couple things situationally with Clemson, just as an acknowledgement of how talented their defense is in general, but particularly what they have up front. But with that said, Dwayne asked the possibility of Derwin being healthy. One in a million question mark. Are you telling me there's a chance?
Yeah, look, I think that everybody wants Derwin James to play in this game if he's healthy, but the real key word there is if he's healthy, right? I mean, Derwin James is a generational talent. Florida State's goals for the season are shot. There's literally no reason to come back before you're 110% healthy. That is a tricky injury that you can seriously mess up if you come back too early. And I think you and I and other people in the media had skepticism of Derwin being back in this, what was it, they say 5 to 7 week timetable or something like that. A lot of people, including people who are injury experts for the NFL on Twitter, who are actual doctors, said things like, huh, that's more like a 12-week injury. And that, you know, they'd be surprised if they saw Derwin James back. We haven't had a chance to speak with Jimbo Fisher yet this week, so I guess we'll have to see what he says. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm not expecting Derwin James to play. Maybe he surprises me, but at this point, I think it'd be a surprise.
The last thing I would ever hope for is to watch Derwin James play at a level that we would not expect, and to think in the back of mind it was because he came back too early for a season that really had nothing to gain. Look, if Derwin's back by the Florida game, that's great. If Derwin doesn't play this year, that's great. I completely share your sentiments that is far too special of a talent, and really has a incredible opportunity to pay really serious, significant dividends for Florida State down the line, really in maybe even a more impactful way as far as having some kind of transcendent NFL player who certainly loves this university and would be a great, all the byproduct or all the kind of things that come from having a real impactful player and being able to point at him and his experience in your program would really be a better for you in the long run for this program. So I, from everything I've heard, I don't think he will play against Clemson. I'm not like saying that with certainty, but that's kind of become a little bit more accepted internally from the people that I've talked to. So we'll see. Things can change. Bye week's a nice chance to evaluate him. But at this point, I would be surprised if he's playing at 8 o'clock next Saturday. The next question that I see is a pretty interesting one, comes from Dakota, who frequently asks pretty good questions of us, and appreciate your listenership and the feedback you've given us. Bud, he asks, what recruiting pitches will rival coaching staffs use against FSU on the recruiting trail after a potential 9-3, 8-4 type season?
Oh, it's easy. If I'm an opposing recruiter, I'm telling kids that Jimbo Fisher ain't shit without Jameis Winston. Period. That's what I'm telling them. I mean, think about how many ball games they've lost without Jameis. It would be, 4-4-2. Last year was 3. This year's probably going to be 4-5. That's where I'm going with it. He's not an elite coach without Jameis Winston. Now, you and I know that's not necessarily true, in that Jameis didn't make that team. There was a ton of future NFL stars on that team. But if I'm an opposing coach, that's absolutely what I'm going to say.
Yeah, you don't necessarily have to be the things that maybe make the most impact on the recruiting trail aren't all the times true. So, as bizarre as that sounds, it's not something that you necessarily have to have on your side to have an impactful and meaningful recruiting pitch. Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's exactly what you have, and that whoever you are, you're probably selling fresh regime. You know, you're probably selling that you're building something, that you have a chance to be special, you have a chance to make your mark, you have a chance to be the people who really turn the program around. All the things that Florida State so successfully put out there on the market 5 or 6 years ago, and that's probably your pitch. So that's a good question. Interesting to see how much you hear that. Florida State's going to be Florida State and still do well on the recruiting trail. Of all the concerns that I have for this program, how they recruit is not anywhere near the top.
All right. Next question is, this is from Justin. If FSU recruits on par with Ohio State, why can't they reload every year after year like Ohio State? Coaching, talent, conference, all of the above. Well, they don't recruit on par with Ohio State. I think we pointed this out before. Bama's a pretty clear number one. Ohio State's a pretty clear number two. And Ohio State is in that group with Florida State's in that group with LSU, Notre Dame, and some others. Now, coaching, certainly, yeah. Ohio State's coaching staff is a hell of a lot better than Florida State's coaching staff. I mean, Urban Meyer runs circles around Jimbo Fisher in terms of game management. He's clearly willing to make coaching changes when necessary. I think bringing Greg Schiano in to coach defense was a brilliant move. Look, they're also more committed in terms of staff size and financial commitment than Florida State is. But no, Florida State does not recruit like them. That's a misnomer. Ohio State brings in significantly more talent than Florida State brings in. All right. Jason asks, how much of FSU performance against Wake would you attribute to letdown, hangover coming off the emotional win over Miami? I think some, but not all, because you've seen this, especially the bad offense in the first half. That's not been an anomaly. That's been the consistent thing every week from this team. And that was really where they were bad in this game. In the second half, they had some turnovers, but the offense moved the ball. It's just another terrible start in the first half. So I would say not much in that regard, because they do it every week.
But next question asked is by SA. He asks, with as much pressure as teams are getting, why aren't the coaches scheming more screens, draws, and bubbles to slow down post and pass rusher?
You know, that's an interesting question. They do have some bubble screen type stuff. They try to run a couple screens. They're not a very good middle screen team, I think we discussed before.
I think if we just try it a couple more times, though, we're going to end up hitting that.
Yeah, that really is a play they should retire. Just because that's a play that, like, the air raid teams run really well, and Florida State is certainly not an air raid or a spread team at all, and they just run that so poorly that somebody makes a critical error on that every time. I agree, they should probably try some more screens and draws. Ultimately, I don't think you want to feel like you have to do that against Wake Forest. In what ways will offenses pick on Armin Lane? Stack receiver sets, motion? Sorry. Well, actually, we'll answer this one. This is from Jackson. That's a good question. I think that there's probably a number of ways they're going to try and go at him. Right now, no team that FSU's faced really has the ability to pick on him. It'll be interesting to see how he plays in space a little bit more. I think he's been a lot better than I thought he was going to be. I don't know how much stacked receiver sets will necessarily mess with him unless they're unless there's not in another another receiver on the field. But he seems to actually be pretty heads up in terms of grasping the defense and in terms of, like, he's the guy waving his arms that we don't have somebody lined up on the other sideline, right?
Exactly.
Which is encouraging. They'll probably try to run some jerk routes on him, and they'll probably, if they get him in man coverage, they'll certainly try to run some double moves.
You'll see a wheel. Yeah, I mean, you'll probably see a wheel route. You'll see some things. But that kid's made a pretty incredible adaption. Even people, like, within the program commented that they were surprised by how much he knew or how much he seemed to pick up just in the first week of practice. It's a pretty incredible transition he's made and a remarkable ability to pick up what's being asked of him.
Uncle Bennis asks, is Francois the most talented quarterback on FSU's roster? Right now, I would say yes. Now, does Malik Henry potentially have more potential than him? Yeah, I think so. But there's also a lot more built-in risk. So I'm going to say yes. I think Francois is.
It's sort of impossible to say if Malik Henry's more talented. Yeah, you have a brief little window of time in the spring game, but certainly nobody else that you'd bring into this conversation currently on the roster, and would be real tough to say that Henry was a more talented product than what you've seen out of Francois. Next question, but again from Jackson, ask if opposing defenses are potentially gaming Jimbo's offenses to dictate checks into either the run or the pass.
Well, all defenses do this to an extent, and the reason you would do it is if you really load the box, then they're gonna throw the football more. I don't think this is an FSU specific thing, to be honest. But all defenses do that to some extent.
I think he may be asking if opposing defenses are giving a look, are kind of almost giving a dummy look that they think the offense will then check into a situation that maybe they're better prepared for than what they showed. But interesting question. Jackson asked one more of us, Bud, and that is, if he has five more questions, would you potentially buy him a Nolcast Bloody Mary?
If he gets five more people to review us on iTunes, I think I would consider treating him to a Nolcast Bloody Mary, assuming he is of age, of course, because it's a delicious alcoholic drink. Available at our fine sponsor, Madison Social. Madison Social, the finest place for food and drink in Tallahassee, right there in College Town, right in the shadow of Doak Campbell Stadium. Some great weather coming to Tallahassee this week. I know David Visser, our managing editor of Tomahawk Nation, tweeted out, Ingram, have you seen the weather that you can enjoy some excellent beverages on Madison Social's patio this weekend?
Yeah, I have. It's been really nice weather in general through this part of the country, and it's been a welcome change. And Tallahassee is always about 10 degrees or so north of where I am on the thermometer, but I can only imagine how nice of a situation and some of the settings that you're able to take in this time of year.
So people make fun of us for reading off lists on this show at times, but here's your highs for the next 10 days. Tuesday, 89. Wednesday, 88. Thursday, 88. Friday, 80. Saturday, 76. 76. That's gonna be nice on that bye week Saturday. Sunday, 80. Monday, 83. Tuesday, 82. Wednesday, 83. You know what number I did not rattle off in there? 90, which means the drinks should taste extra nice outside at Madison Social. And yet the folks at Madison Social also have a new concept. It's an Italian place, and I know you're eager to tell our listeners about.
Absolutely. Give it a look. It's the latest offering that For the Table, the group there that Madison Social is part of, has brought. It's right there in the same area. Fantastic, authentically Italian dishes. Centrale is the place that we're referring to. They themselves have a pretty awesome Bloody Mary, amongst other things. So would encourage just a general tour of the properties and the sponsors. And I will tell you, Jackson, if you can send us a email and prove that you are of age, I'll be happy to buy you a drink at either of those locations and appreciate your listenership. So we'll put that on the table and encourage people to go and enjoy those two places and appreciate all the support that they've given us. And they've been a massive pillar in allowing us to bring you as much content as we have over the past two football seasons.
All right. Let me see here. Champions Club. Question from Polly says, Champions Club seats, pretty empty. Randy Sanders up in the booth. Anything to it? What recruit could be a game changer for FSU? So Polly's got several questions here. Always like, oh, I think these are great questions.
I did not realize until right now that that those are three questions and not two. At first, I was reading that as though he somehow thought Randy Sanders was tied to some of the lack of seating that we've seen in the Champions Club.
Did he fit all that in one tweet? That's very impressive.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, sometimes I'll rewrite a tweet a couple times to see if I can fit everything I want to say in 140 characters. Ultimately, some of my best work goes untweeted because I just can't. But, okay. Champions Club seats, pretty empty. From what I can tell, it seems like it's very full inside and people just have not been sitting in the actual seats on the outside. I think we're going to actually talk about that in a later podcast. So let's go ahead and agree to table that discussion, Polly. Certainly something that's been on our minds as well. Randy Sanders up in the booth, anything to it? I think they wanted a different look to identify things that defenses are doing and somebody who thinks a lot like Jimbo Fisher. The negative of that is that if Sanders is not on the sideline, he's not getting able to talk to Francois in person necessarily between series. And so Jimbo's having to do it. There's positive and negatives to that, I guess. What recruit would be a game changer for Florida State? Well, I think Cam Akers, your running back, would be a big-time game changer for FSU because you're going to lose Dalvin Cook to the draft after this year. And that is something that is going to hurt this offense a lot in 2017. But Cam Akers should come in and I think could potentially start for FSU as a true freshman. So that's saying a lot, but he's an excellent back. I know that Ole Miss thinks that they have a good shot at him. I know Ohio State does, but LSU also does. And Florida State visited his high school today, Monday.
Akers would be a hell of a prospect, a guy we've talked a long time on this podcast over the past 6 months or so about his involvement and maybe that Florida State was a much more serious contender than people were willing to acknowledge during the summer. So that will not be a name that is unfamiliar to listeners of ours and certainly something that we will follow and continue to discuss. But at this point, John asks, who should we be worried about potentially losing early to the NFL draft?
Well, certainly Dalvin Cook, who we just said. Rod Johnson, left tackle. Derek Nnadi is an interesting question at defensive tackle because he didn't play very well early in the season, but it may just be that he was a lot more injured, and he's played very well in the last couple weeks. If he continues that trend, I think he could go early. Matthew Thomas certainly is a player who I think people are underestimating his chance to go early. Not that he would be a high draft choice, but I think he's a very athletic guy who would test well. And he's already been ineligible once, and classes don't get easier as you matriculate through college. They get harder. So I think there's some chance he could go. I don't think Travis Rudolph should go. I don't think he'd be drafted very high at all. Is there somebody I'm missing here?
No, I don't think so. I think Thomas is probably more likely to go than not. You don't ever want to say, oh, one game. But look, if Nnadi has some type of significant performance against Clemson, I think that'll be the most interesting one to watch. And if he continues this upwardly trend, I think you're probably looking at him leaving early. And hey, if that's the case, good for him. You know, I mean, with a situation like that, a position like that, if you play yourself into a second round grade or so, I think that's a great place for him. And I would be impressed by what he was able to do during his time here.
Agreed. Let's ask a couple more of these. Oh, I have one from email, guys. You can always hit us up on email. That's thenolcast@gmail.com. Hey, bud, my name is Markel, huge FSU fan. My question for you is this. Do you believe that because the schedule is getting easier, for the most part, he says, leading to more wins, that Jimbo Fisher and the rest of the staff might become complacent and believe that there is improvement that isn't actually there? Question mark. He says, I fear this. Can you address this on the Nolcast? Thanks for your time. Well, Markel, thank you for listening. And guys, if you have a question that is too long for Twitter, email also works just fine for us. I mean, we appreciate questions that are quick to read on air, but we know that sometimes they require nuance and perhaps more than the 140 characters that Twitter will give you. Yeah, I think that's a legitimate concern that Markel brings up, especially on the defensive side of the ball, because the offenses FSU is going to face here, you know, Boston College's offense is a train wreck. Florida's offense is not very good. Syracuse offense is high-flying, but it's also pretty inefficient at times. Who am I missing here on the schedule still who's not a very good offense? NC State actually has a pretty decent offensive attack. But yeah, I think there's a good chance that Florida State has a winning record in its final games here. Does that I do think that there is some chance that the ease of schedule could result in misevaluation of staff by the head man. But Ingram, what do you think the chances are that this happens?
Oh, tough to say entirely. I mean, it'll be dictated in how Florida State plays, how it closes, but I don't know. I mean, I would want to say maybe like 25-30%. It's hard to say exactly. Here's what I'll try to condense this into. Whatever the percentage is, I'd probably add an extra 5-10% to it, because I think more times than not, Jimbo Fisher values loyalty. More times than not, Jimbo Fisher has shown a tendency to not make a move. So, whatever the percentage is, if you want to put one on it, I'd be interested to know. I would probably tack an extra 8-10% on that, just because I think that's probably the way that your head coach is inclined and how he's historically leaned.
I do think he's going to receive pressure, though, to make some changes on this staff from powerful people.
Well, a lot of it will depend on Saturday night. Yeah, I mean, look, if you go out and get rolled against Clemson, I don't care what your defense looks like the rest of the year. Too much of that book's already been written. So, yeah, I agree with you. The pressure will be there regardless. But if something happens, not this weekend, but next, where Clemson comes in here and hangs a number on you at home, and the defense is, having some of the problems, some of the situations that we saw through the first five games, then I don't really think the rest of the year matters at that point.
I would have to agree with that. All right, let's get a couple more here. We already answered an Ermin Lane question, but I do think that what he's doing is encouraging. So thank you, Brian. Cam asks, has DeAndre Francois reached his potential for the year, or will he need an entire offseason to get better? Yeah, I think Francois could get better down the stretch, especially if he gets healthier. I don't know how good his shoulder is right now. And I think he'll get healthier as he plays some worse defenses. I mean, Boston College's defense is actually not that great this year, and Syracuse's defense is a train wreck. I think he'll probably get better in year two as well. Yeah, the question is, what's his ultimate ceiling? Because I don't think either you or I think it's a Jameis, and I don't know how much accuracy can be taught, and he just routinely misses on wide-open throws far too often, not delivering a ball that's even within the vicinity of the receiver.
I think what you have to think about Francois is that he's shown you enough things to be excited and to retain some optimism. And that at this point, with where I think he is physically, again, it's a good time to have a bye week. But I just don't know that you're going to see that much improvement from where he is right now. He's certainly had some nice flashes and a lot of reason to think that, you know, year three with DeAndre Francois could look pretty special. I'm personally remain pretty optimistic as far as what he can turn into, but I don't know that you're going to see a real large leap from what you saw in the first six games as opposed to what you'll see in the next six.
I would agree with that. All right. Seth asks, is it time to give Tyler, that's Logan Tyler, a look at kicks? Is if Aguayo isn't making the short field goals, I don't see why he can't get a shot. How bad can he be? Well, I think Aguayo has made some of the shorter field goals this year. He's been, I think, 2 of 7 in field goals over 40 yards. Now, part of this is stop trying to kick so many field goals and actually coach well, which is going for some of these fourth downs and managing your third down so that you actually have a chance at a makeable fourth down. And that's not saying play for fourth down. It's saying throw an underneath route sometimes on, you know, 3rd and 7 from the 43 so that maybe you pick up 5 yards and all of a sudden you got 4th and 2 from the 38 or something like that, right? Maybe he picks it up, but maybe he doesn't. You can take advantage of defenses that are playing at the sticks on third down in that sort of 25-yard zone there, that really gives you a great shot to either convert it or to pick it up if you go for fourth down. So the number one is stop mismanaging the game and actually coach well, coach smart. Number two, I think absolutely Logan Tyler deserves a shot at field goals over, let's say, 45 yards. But the issue has not been necessarily a lack of leg strength from Aguayo. Like, these are not coming up way short, right? They're just being missed. Now, Ingram, I'll ask you this. Do you think that perhaps a lack of leg strength from Aguayo causes him to overexert himself on some of these longer kicks, thus causing his mechanics to break down more often than they do on the shorter kicks?
I think that's entirely possible. I do. I think that to answer his question, or at least my opinion with it, I think Aguayo has been about probably what we anticipated him to be. I don't know that I'd make a change there. I agree. Anything north of 45 yards, I'd probably let Tyler have a crack at it. But from everything we heard, Tyler was fairly inconsistent as far as his performance coming into fall. So I don't know that. I think that's just kind of like, you know, the backup quarterback. That's always a great option until you see it. I don't know that you'd get any kind of increase in performance as far as just how many he's likely to make, how many 39-yard field goals, for example, how many he's going to make. Again, longer kicks, I'm all for letting Tyler run out there and take a crack at him, but I don't know that I would experiment with who your traditional place kicker is at this point.
All right, just a couple more here. What adjustments does the defense need to make to keep the score under 35? If that's done, chance of winning. I think we'll save that probably for Clemson week. We're a little bit early out here, but D.A. Clark, I really appreciate the question. I think we're going to mark that one to save. Rob Jones says, can Jimbo not find the right QB to run his offense, or does he just ask too much of his QB? Well, I think he can. I don't think that Francois is necessarily the wrong QB to run his offense. I do think it's fair to question how effective this style of offense can be in this relative to other styles in the current rules climate of college football that allows for some, you know, very interesting things. If you look up, I believe Chris Lowe had this article, ESPN, longtime SEC writer. It's not so much that Alabama handed Tennessee the second most lopsided defeat in the history of this series. Alabama won 51-0 way back in 1906. It's the way the Crimson Tide did it and the way they continue to evolve as they keep winning games. Their overall winning streak is up to 19 games now, the longest active streak in the FBS. Well, obviously they won the national title last year, so yeah. Quote, you play the way you need to play under the rules the way they are, Saban said. If you don't, you're going to get left behind. End quote. Think about it. Did anybody really see Saban playing a true freshman quarterback 5 years ago? For that matter, did anybody see Saban breaking away from his pro-style approach and running the quarterback as much as Alabama is with Jalen Hurts, who torched the Vols for 132 rushing yards and 3 touchdowns on 12 carries? But here's the clincher. Tide are going hurry up on offense, using tempo, not huddling, and spreading out the defense. The style of football Saban was railing against as recently as 3 years ago. For a guy who's been accused more than once of being stubborn and a creature of habit, Saban is as progressive as they come when it comes to his football team. He flashes a wry smile when asked how it feels to officially be one of the, quote, fastball guys, his term for coaches who run the hurry-up offense, the same offenses that were allegedly his kryptonite on defense when he had the audacity to go two straight years in 2013 and 2014 without winning a national championship. The reality is offensive coordinator Lane Kiffin is the one who transformed Alabama's offense, but Saban is the one who brought Kiffin in and gave him the license. Yes, through animated exchanges, blah, blah, blah. Talks about how Saban, you know, gave him some ass chewings on the sideline. But it's a fact that Hurts, an explosive athlete, adds a whole different dimension to the Alabama offense with his ability to run his own read, make people miss, and throw the ball on the move. So, man, I
lot to take away from that. Yeah.
A lot. You have to adapt. If the rules of college football are such that it's worth scrapping a type of offense that you won four national titles with or five or whatever, doesn't that say something? It really does call into question whether the type of offense Florida State is running is the most effective type of offense to run in the current rules climate. Specifically, 3 yards downfield for offensive linemen, the ability to run block but then throw the football down the field. Not this RPO stuff that FSU says it does, where it throws to the side and the lateral stuff. I'm talking about the vertical, you know, throwing the slants, throwing the post when your linemen are down the field, totally screwing with the defense, and consistently running the quarterback. I mean, that's pretty telling to me.
That's kind of where we come. I mean, you don't want to oversimplify it, but it's all about linebackers and safeties having traditional reads that you can't make anymore. I mean, you can't read run based off of what you see linemen do. Or you can try, but you can also get the ball pulled back and they can throw it right in the hole that you created because you read traditional run and have come up in run support. So yeah, it's that is, and I also don't want this I don't want the RPO conversation to like have some kind of just get built in as this all encompassing either doing it or you're not, or that it becomes just like the one thing that we're judging this offense by. But it is what modern football has become. And if you're not doing it and you're not taking advantage of what the current rules are, or at least how they're calling the current rules, then you're absolutely putting yourself at a competitive disadvantage, just as you are in any other walk in life, if you don't take advantage of what the guidelines are and what the boundaries are as far as how you can operate and try to be as successful as possible within them.
I absolutely agree. I mean, Petrino switched, Saban switched. A lot of very successful pro-style coaches are going to it because it's literally, if you can't beat them, join them type of thing. All right, from Henry, I believe. While we're evaluating coaches on staff, shouldn't we take a look at the strength conditioning position, possible players to be physical, weak, and lack of toughness? This is a good illustration of a question that might be better for email because there's a lot. Sometimes we can abbreviate so much, and I do this too, that it's tough for me to discern exactly what the question means. But yeah, look, I think you need to take a look at all the coaches. That doesn't mean make changes at all the coaching spots, but I'm sure Jimbo Fisher needs to take a long, hard look at his program here. I think it's very fair to say that 2014 underachieved pretty significantly. They received a lot of close game luck, and they pulled a lot of games out, but they certainly didn't dominate. 2015 was kind of a rebuilding / learning year, and 2016 is already a failure and an underachieving year. So yeah, two of your last 3 years are underachieving, I think, and not playing necessarily to your talent level. And the other year that wasn't was a kind of a teaching / learning year. So, yes, look at everybody.
look at everybody. I feel like fans become overly critical of the strength and conditioning. It's like one of those things that they just reach for sometimes. So we've talked about the strength and conditioning program, and maybe that some people think that the current regime is really good at taking superstars' ceilings even higher, but maybe not raising the collective floor.
Some people on staff specifically, not us, like coaches on staff who talk to us or talk to people we know. Yeah.
But I also think that it's just a lot of things that as soon as people aren't happy with their own particular college program, they start to question and start to wonder how effective it is. So just something I would point out there. But I want to select maybe one final question of the evening, as we're probably run about as long as we can on this particular episode.
Agreed. Yeah, I'm getting pretty tired. I think my performance may be lacking. Maybe I need better strength and conditioning. Hey, did you see Goldberg came back to Raw tonight?
No, really?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
That's funny. That's a reminder of my 7th and 8th grade youth, the middle school. Absolutely. Goldberg.
Colin Savage asks, we're losing to NC State, right? And I don't know, man. Like, maybe. I think that game is probably a coin flip type game right now, the way FSU's played. But I don't know. Let's ask this. We've done this after every week. Are you changing your win-loss prediction?
No, I think I'm gonna stay put here.
At 9-3,
nothing from what I saw. Yeah, I was kind of right between the 4 and the 3, but I will stay at 9-3, and at this point, somewhat hoping for it, but I'm not gonna move from where I was.
I'm gonna stick with 8-4. I think there's a better chance that they lose two more than they lose one more. So I'm gonna go 8-4. And stick with that. It's been a good show, man. We are at an hour and 23 minutes, and I'm sure it'll be cut down a little bit. For everybody out there, very much appreciate you tweeting us. That's at Nolcast, emailing us, and as always, finding us on iTunes. We have a couple good new reviews, including one that I thought was pretty funny. I'm not going to read it on air because it's several hundred words. Talks about Louisiana Hot Sauce and the sponsors a lot in a positive light. But from our most recent one, October 14th, this is the best FSU podcast, hands down. You always look like the smartest and most informed fan at your tailgate. As a Noel grad stuck in San Francisco, I sometimes feel isolated from my alma mater. The Noelcast always makes me feel like I'm back in God's country. That's from Paddywagon 17. Very much appreciate that, guys. Who knows? Maybe we will read your iTunes review on the show if it's a good one. 5 stars. We are now up to 426 5-star ratings, Ingram. That's very impressive.
It's good. Good. I always appreciate the feedback that we've received and interaction in whatever form. So we're very fortunate to have the sponsors that we do, and that's only a byproduct of the listenership and the feedback and interaction that we've had with y'all. So appreciate it. Hopefully you've enjoyed this. Hopefully informative. At times, maybe a little bit more negative than we would have wanted to be, certainly at this point in the season, but it's what we've witnessed so far. But it's been a great kind of process. We've been doing this for 6 or 7 years. We've really been able to step up the regularity and consistency of product and just the content, having it out at regularly scheduled times. But to go through a season like this is interesting. Yeah, you ebb and flow emotionally probably more than you want to, even when you're intentionally making an effort not to. But it's a season that would have been damn near impossible to predict. It certainly hasn't played out the way that that like the fan base would have wanted it to. Still some left to play for, but a season that's not necessarily over, but a season that is capped significantly as far as how successful it'll be. So excited to see the rest of it, excited to be able to sit here with you and the listeners and talk about it, and just want to thank everybody for the feedback and everything that they've given us to allow a podcast that we started 6 or 7 years ago to be able to have a point where it's routinely rated as one of the highest in its genre and it has the listenership as it does. So we're fortunate to be able to do this, and thank you to everybody who gives us a listen.
Absolutely, guys. And Ingram, as always, thanks for being a great co-host, and we'll talk to you again very soon. Take care, y'all.